You're listening to Radio Hangar. Aviation talk, powered by AI, fueled by passion. This is the Hangar and I'm Taildragger. Glad you're here today because I've been wanting to tell this story for a long time, and I mean a long time. We're going back more than 80 years to a chapter of aviation history that got buried, nearly forgotten, and then clawed its way back into the light where it belongs. We're talking about the Women Air Force Service Pilots, the WASP. And if you think you know this story, pull up a chair, because I promise you there are pieces of it that'll surprise you. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. If you love flying the way I love flying, these folks get it. Gear, apparel, and gifts for people who live and breathe aviation. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's set the scene. It's 1942. America is deep into the war. We're fighting on two fronts and we need pilots. We need a lot of pilots. Every man who can fly is getting shipped overseas to fly combat missions in Europe and the Pacific. But here's the problem. Somebody still has to fly stateside. Somebody has to ferry brand new fighters and bombers from the factories to the bases. Somebody has to tow targets for aerial gunnery practice. Somebody has to test aircraft that have just come out of maintenance, aircraft that might or might not be airworthy. And the military is running out of men to do it. Now here's where it gets interesting. Two women saw this coming before almost anyone else did. Jacqueline Cochran and Nancy Harkness. Love, both of them were already accomplished pilots. Cochran had set speed and altitude records. Love had been flying since she was 16 years old and had logged serious cross-country time. They came at the problem from different angles, but they arrived at the same conclusion. American women could fly military aircraft. And they should. Love got there first, organizationally. In September of 1942, she stood up the Women's Auxiliary Ferrying Squadron, the WAFS, under the Air Transport Command. She handpicked 28 women, all of them experienced pilots with at least 500 hours. These weren't students. These were seasoned aviators. Cochran, meanwhile, had been pushing for something bigger. She wanted a full training program, taking women with basic flying skills and turning them into military pilots. She got her wish with the Women's Flying Training Detachment, based at Avenger Field in Sweetwater, Texas. In 1943, the two programs merged into the WASP, with Cochran as director. Let me tell you about Avenger Field. Because if you've never been to Sweetwater, Texas in the summer, you're not missing much unless you're there for the history. It's flat, it's hot, the wind blows dust into everything. Your eyes, your ears, your food, and that's where more than 25,000 women applied to serve. Out of those 25,000, only 1,800 were accepted, and of those 1,800, just over 1,000 graduated. Think about that washout rate, more than 40%. These women went through the same Army Air Force's flight training curriculum as the male cadets. Primary, basic, advanced instruments, formation, cross-country navigation. They flew the Stearman PT-17, the Volte BT-13, and the North American AT-6 Texan. They got their wings, and then they went to work. And what work it was. The WASP ended up flying every aircraft in the Army Air Force's inventory. Every single one. Let that sink in. We're talking about the P-51 Mustang, the P-47 Thunderbolt, the P-38 Lightning, the B-17 Flying Fortress, the B-26 Marauder, which had such a nasty reputation for killing pilots that the men were sometimes reluctant to fly it. The women flew it, they flew the B-29 Superfortress, they flew everything. Now I want to pause here and talk about the B-26 for a minute, because this is one of those stories that just gets me. The Martin B-26 Marauder had a terrible safety record early in the war. It was fast, it was hot, it had a high wing loading, and it was unforgiving on takeoff and landing. The men at some training bases were refusing to fly it. Morale was in the dirt. So what did the brass do? They brought in WASP pilots to fly the B-26. The thinking was simple, and frankly a little insulting in its origins. If the women could fly it, the men would be shamed into getting back in the cockpit. But here's the thing, the women didn't just fly the Marauder, they flew it well. They towed targets with it, they demonstrated it. And yeah, the men got back in the airplane. But the real story isn't about shaming anyone. The real story is that those women climbed into a machine that had a reputation as a widowmaker, and they did the job. Period. There's a name I want you to remember. Anne Baumgartner, Carl. She was the first American woman to fly a jet aircraft when she took up a Bell YP-59 Aerocomet in 1944. First American woman in a jet, and hardly anyone knows her name. Here's another one, Cornelia Fort. She was already a flight instructor at an airfield near Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. She was in the air that morning giving a lesson. When the Japanese attacked, she saw the planes, she saw the bombs falling. She got her student and herself back on the ground alive. She later joined the WAFS and was killed in a mid-air collision during a ferrying mission in 1943. She was the first female pilot in American history to die on active duty. 38 WASP members gave their lives in service, 38 women who died flying for their country. And here is the part of the story that should make you angry. When a WASP pilot was killed, the military would not pay to send her body home. Her fellow WASP members would pass the hat. They'd take up a collection among themselves to cover the cost of shipping their friend's remains to her family. The United States government, for whom these women were flying and dying, would not cover the funeral expenses. Because the WASP were never militarized. They served as civilians. Cochrane had pushed for full military status, and a bill was introduced in Congress in 1944 to make the WASP part of the Army Air Forces. It was defeated, lobbied against in fact by male civilian pilots who were worried about their own jobs as the war wound down. The program was disbanded on December 20, 1944. The women were sent home with no veterans' benefits, no GI Bill, no health care, no official recognition. They were told essentially, thanks, now go away. And then to add insult to injury, their records were classified, sealed, hidden away. For more than 30 years, it was as if the WASP had never existed. Let me take a breath here because this part of the story always gets to me. It wasn't until 1977 that the records were finally unsealed, largely through the efforts of former WASP members who just refused to be erased, and when the Air Force started claiming that its first female pilot class in 1976 was a historic first. The surviving WASP said, "Excuse me, we did this 33 years ago." Congress finally granted the WASP retroactive veteran status in 1977, more than three decades after they'd served. In 2009, President Obama signed legislation awarding the Congressional Gold Medal to the women Air Force service pilots. When the ceremony was held in 2010 at the Capitol, more than 200 surviving WASP members attended. Most of them were in their late 80s and 90s. They came in wheelchairs and on walkers. They wore their uniforms. And they stood as tall as they could. I'm going to tell you something. I have met fighter aces who didn't carry themselves with that kind of dignity. Now, I promised you a restoration angle, and I want to deliver on that, because there's something happening in the Warbird community that connects directly to this story. Across the country, there are restoration teams working to keep the aircraft the WASP flew alive and flying, and I'm not just talking about the glamorous fighters, though there are gorgeous P-51 restorations out there. I'm talking about the trainers. The Stearmans, the B-13s, the AT-6s. These are the aircraft that the WASP actually spent most of their time in, and they matter. At the National WASP World War II Museum in Sweetwater, Texas, right there at the old Avenger Field, they've been working for years to preserve not just the documents and photographs, but the physical connection to these women. There's a Stearman on display that evokes exactly what those trainees experienced. When you stand next to it, you can almost smell the oil and the dust and the Texas heat. But the restoration that really caught my attention recently is the work being done on flyable AT-6 Texans that are being restored with WASP history, specifically in mind. Painting them in the markings these women flew, documenting which aircraft went through Avenger Field, connecting specific tail numbers to specific pilots when the records allow it. It's detective work as much as it is mechanical work. You've got restorers digging through those newly declassified records, matching serial numbers, tracking down which airplane went where and who flew it. There's something powerful about that. It's one thing to read about history. It's another thing entirely to hear a Pratt and Whitney R-1340 WASP engine. And yes, the engine family shared the name, fire up on a cold morning and know that an aircraft just like this one, maybe this very one, was flown by a 23-year-old woman from Iowa who'd been told her whole life that girls don't fly airplanes. The Commemorative Air Force, formerly the Confederate Air Force, has been particularly active in keeping WASP history alive through their flying fleet. Several of their wings have dedicated aircraft and programs to telling the WASP story at air shows across the country. When you see a CAF AT-6 Texan or BT-13 Valiant at a fly-in with WASP markings and a placard telling the story, that's not an accident. That's dedicated volunteers spending thousands of hours and thousands of dollars to make sure this history doesn't disappear again. And I think that matters more now than it ever has. Because here's the thing about aviation history. If we don't keep the airplanes flying, if we don't keep telling the stories, they fade. And the WASP story faded once already. We can't let it happen again.
I want to leave you with one more image. There's a photograph, and I think you can find it at the National Archives, of four WASP pilots walking away from a B-17. They're in their flight suits. Their hair is blowing in the prop wash. They're smiling. They've just landed a 65,000-pound, four-engine heavy bomber. And they look like it was the most natural thing in the world, because for them it was more than 1,000 women earned their wings as WASP. 38 of them died serving a country that wouldn't even call them veterans for another three decades, and every single one of them could fly. That's the story, and it's one we should never stop telling sources. For today's segment include research from the National WASP World War II Museum in Sweetwater, Texas, historical archives maintained by the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, the Texas Woman's University WASP Collection, which holds the largest archive of WASP documents and oral histories, and published histories from the Commemorative Air Force and the Experimental Aircraft Association. also drew on the congressional record from the 1977 Veteran Status Legislation and the 2009 Congressional Gold Medal Award. As always, Radio Hangar is an AI-generated broadcast built by folks who genuinely love aviation. Everything we share, we source, and we tell you where it came from. You can find more about the show and our past segments at RadioHangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Thanks for spending some time in the hangar with me today. Go find a WASP story to share with someone who hasn't heard it yet. These women earned that much and a whole lot more. Fly safe, everybody. Radio Hangar, keep the blue side up.